time to wake to sleep with Sleep Science Today, where we learn to sleep well with your host, Andrew Kolsky, on UK Health Radio.
Hello, welcome to Sleep Science Today, the show where we talk about sleep and the science behind sleep. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. Today we have an expert in sleep and cancer issues. This is Dr. Alexi Mensch. She is a psychologist in Pennsylvania. I'm going to let her give you the full title because there's a word salad in there. But we're going to be talking about sleep and cancer and a lot of issues related to that. So let me start off by saying welcome, Dr. Mensch.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be back. So I am a clinical health psychologist. I work at Penn Medicine, Princeton Health. I specialize in the treatment of distress in cancer. They call us psycho-oncologists, and more specifically, sleep disturbance and treatment of fatigue in cancer and cancer survivorship.
Wow. You know, I've never heard that term before, psycho-oncologist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're out there.
how many people in the world focus on this area? It's got to be a small number of people.
Oh, gosh, you're really testing me. I couldn't tell you how many psycho-oncologists there are. I know there's a few. I know the folks who work in the Penn system and around Pennsylvania and New Jersey who do this work. I can say that Sloan Kettering has a pretty robust program. I want to shout them out because the founder and mother of psycho-oncology was at Sloan. So I want to just give them their kudos. But I can't say how many. I can tell you that it is a small group of us and growing who do work in sleep and cancer. So the treatment of sleep disorders, the identification of sleep disorders, the treatment of fatigue and cancer survivorship. I don't want to get the number wrong, but I would say there's maybe a handful, maybe 10 of us in North America who are doing this work. But it's a growing field. I keep reviewing more and more papers coming through, so it's wonderful because it's growing.
Yeah, wow. Because I mean, the field of sleep itself is relatively small, and now we're talking about a subset of that. Yeah. So, just for the audience's knowledge, I mean, Lexi is who I turn to if I have any questions about sleep and cancer-related things, because there are so few people. She's the only one that I know, actually, that does it. So I'm glad to have you here.
Yeah, a small cohort of people, but interestingly, a really large problem, meaning that sleep disturbance and cancer-related fatigue affect most folks who get diagnosed at some point. Doesn't mean that the problem persists, but it's a major complaint, and we still don't really know what to do about the fatigue piece. Sleep's a little bit easier. We have some evidence-based treatments, so I'm glad to see that there's more scientists kind of joining forces here to figure this out.
Yes, yes. No, it's such an important thing, and that kind of brings us right into our beginning question here, which is, so, you know, the way this topic even came up for me at all was I do clinical work with people with insomnia a lot, and I had a patient come to me, and her issue was that she had gone through cancer treatment, breast cancer, and after that, she had, you know, continuing medications and treatments and all these things that were going on in her life. And of course, she also now had insomnia. And she was at that age where a lot of my patients are sort of in that age group that they have insomnia. But now on top of that, she had this cancer treatment. And so my first thing is, well, is this related to the cancer treatment? Is it related to her age? Is it both? And then we started getting into the concept of sleep versus fatigue. Are you sleepy or are you fatigued? Because the two are obviously different. And it's a really interesting area, and that's why I wanted to have you on. Can you tell us just give us a primer. What's the difference between sleep and fatigue and other types of issues that people may have? And then we can talk about how to deal with these things.
Yeah, that's a really great question and one that comes up a lot with patients. So when we think about sleepiness, it's your ability to fall and stay asleep, right? How drowsy are you? Most of us, if not all of us, have had the experience, right, of our eyes getting heavy. We feel like we can't stay awake. We hopefully lay down and fall asleep. That's sleepiness. This isn't like a systematic way to measure this, but what I say to patients is, if I put a bed in the room right now, would you feel like you were going to fall asleep? Mm-hmm. Fatigue is different and a little bit more amorphous, I would say, and that's probably what makes it harder to measure, is it's low energy. It's feeling like you have the flu almost. Some folks would describe it as a lack of motivation. I don't always love that because it almost feels like it's the person's fault, but it is. It's like, I can't do this thing. And it's not related to how much energy you've expended, right? So cancer-related fatigue, if we compare it to like exercise-induced fatigue, right? If I go run a half marathon, I'm probably going to be pretty tired, sleepy, and fatigued. My muscles might be fatigued. But folks who have cancer-related fatigue don't have to do much, actually don't have to do anything at all to feel this fatigue, which makes it distinct from other fatigues that are studied and we see.
Hmm. So when we talk about fatigue for cancer patients, do we know, does that come as a result of the medication? Does it come as a result of the illness? Do we even know any of this? Tell me more about that part of it.
Yeah, so this is something I think about all the time, probably more than I should. We really don't. I think the suspicion is it comes from a lot of things. Many things can be true. I say this to patients all the time, right? So it's probably a result, and I'm going to talk about the fatigue and the sleep together because I also want to make the case that these things are related.
Okay.
So historically in the literature, there have been some that have said the cancer-related fatigue and the sleep disturbance that may be present are distinct. And they could be initially, but we're starting to think that they're not. And if they're not initially related, they become related. And I'll circle back to that. There are different time points when fatigue can be present as well as sleep disturbance. So initially, even before you get diagnosed, right, your body is potentially developing this illness, maybe a tumor, maybe a blood cancer. And so because of this, you may start to feel more fatigued. Anecdotally, I've had patients come in and say I knew something was wrong because I was more tired than what was usual for me. And then you come to diagnosis, right? And you have the stress of getting diagnosed. That's pretty scary. There's lots of questions. And so that may uptick fatigue because stress can increase how fatigued you are and put you at risk for acute short-term insomnia. And that is the insomnia that falls to the lot of us all, right? Where we have a stressor and it's hard for us to fall asleep. And then the insomnia remits and we are okay. But for about 10% of us, the insomnia persists and you develop chronic insomnia. And so then what you have is chronic insomnia and fatigue. But that doesn't happen to many folks. And then we see fatigue with treatment. And then, like your patient who had the diagnosis of breast cancer, there's medications that some folks go on post-cancer treatment and survivorship to decrease the risk of cancer recurrence. Those are estrogen, they decrease estrogen, and they can also potentially cause fatigue and insomnia. So in summary, it can depend on what's going on, your cancer treatment, your stress level, where you are in the cancer trajectory, but fatigue and insomnia can come and go and wax and wane throughout.
So let me ask this, and it may be an unfair question. If it is, just say so. But as we're talking about fatigue versus sleep, you know, we're talking about it from the context of illness or cancer or medication. There's a lot of people out there who also, from their job or from life stressors, just are sort of, we call it burnt out, you know, burnout. To me, I think burnout and fatigue are the same, but I could be wrong. Have you ever experienced even thinking about what the difference might be, if any?
Well, I think it's important to distinguish between different types of fatigue, and I alluded to this earlier when I was talking about exercise. Mm-hmm. So, sure, if you are overstressed and overworked, I think often of like my trainees in grad school, right? Or my medical students. You're probably going to feel fatigued and maybe sleepy too. Like you need to rest. The body needs to rest. But in cancer, it's distinct. And in other illnesses too, where the fatigue is potentially caused by, related to, exacerbated by the disease, the treatment, you know, the stress. I think a lot as a psychologist, we talk a lot about the biopsychosocial model. Mm-hmm. So your biology, your social environment, your mental health, all of these things can have an impact on how you're feeling, and they're all very interconnected. But yes, I think burnout is important. So if I'm bringing it back to cancer, one thing I talk to my patients about with respect to managing fatigue specifically is energy conservation. It's so important. And it's so important for all of us. We live in a very busy world. I heard somebody say once that, you know, in maybe the 40s and 50s, 1940s and 50s and before, it was aspirational to be a lady who lunches, right? Hmm. You know, you're out in the middle of the day having brunch. Now it's shifted to like, how busy are you, right? We're competing for maximum busyness. I hear it at the, you know, at the drop-off line for my kids. Hmm. Yeah. And we live in a culture of that. And in cancer, there's role changes, right? All of a sudden, you may not be able to be as active as you were before because you're in treatment. You might be limited physically. You might be feeling down because of all of this. All of these things can be true. And so what we're balancing is energy conservation, right? We all could stand to do it. Take a minute. It doesn't have to be extensive. It could be 5 minutes to check in with yourself. So your energy looks stable, like a straight line, versus good day, bad day, good day, bad day. And that will allow for you to be more active, but in a reasonable manner, not going at 100 one day, so the next day you're not feeling so good. And again, this really could apply to everybody. I certainly do it. I have a day where I'm, you know, really pushing the limits, and the next day I don't feel so good.
So, you know, I'm thinking back, and I personally have not experienced this, but my father was an oncologist, so I heard about cancer patients and cancer stories all the time. And I'm sorry to say, my mother actually had two different types of cancer throughout her life. Sorry. So I got to see the impacts of cancer on a person. And I remember when my mom was going through treatment, how medications impacted her iron levels and her blood and everything, and she would be very fatigued from that. And so I'm able to kind of picture what it looks like when a patient is fatigued. And I'm curious, with so many different types of cancer and things out there, and I guess it really goes beyond cancer to other types of illnesses as well, how do you know where to go? A person comes in to you and they say, man, I'm just wiped out. Now that could, and they mix it all, you know, I'm not sleeping and I can barely have enough energy to, you know, get through the day. Where do you even start with that?
Yeah. So whenever I meet with somebody, especially for the first time, and I often talk about this with the students that I'm training, my role as a psycho-oncologist and a health psychologist is triage and really thorough assessment. It's not enough for me to sit down and just ask about mental health. I'm curious, again, about the whole person, the biopsychosocial aspects of this individual and what's going on, right? My training and my competency and my scope is in the treatment of, you know, mental health and behavioral health things. I'm not a physician, to be clear. I'm not prescribing medicine. But I do have a pretty thorough understanding of the cancer trajectory and the medications that they're taking and what labs might need to be done. And so I work Especially right now, I'm housed in the MedOnc clinic. So I sit integrated in that clinic with doctors and nurses and other medical staff and professionals around me. And so when I'm triaging somebody, not just in the assessment, but honestly at follow-up visits, I'm asking about these things. How is your fatigue? How is your sleep? How is your pain? Did you have any symptoms this week? And the medical teams and I work very closely together to make sure that if a patient comes to me and says, actually, this actually just happened. I had a patient come in who said they were having trouble sleeping and they had developed new pain in their back. And given that this was an advanced cancer, you know, and I would have done this anyway, I immediately reached out to his oncologist and the team and said, hey, there's some new pain present. It's disrupting the patient's sleep. I don't think I can do standard sleep treatment with him right now. It has not been long enough. And I'm also concerned that there might be metastases. Within 5 minutes, a scan had been ordered by the MedOnc to make sure that to assess and rule out for metastases to the bone. So that's really how I work, so folks understand as a health psychologist. My role is to, I'm very connected with the medical teams. And also, you know, if a patient sees me before they see their other, you know, their oncologist in a couple weeks, I also sometimes can catch things a little bit sooner, and then the actual physician and med team can follow up on it. And the same goes for fatigue, right? So we're often in our clinic trying to identify and treat these things prophylactically so they don't become exacerbated, so they don't cause other problems, so your immune system is working really well, because we know that sleep is very much tied to your immune health. And so we want that to be working at its full capacity when you're fighting cancer. So these are some of the things that I do and how I work and how I address those things. Like you said, anemia, you know, if somebody comes in and they don't have a history of fatigue and all of a sudden I've been seeing them for 6 weeks and they're like, oh, I'm so fatigued. We're going to send them for blood work and make sure that everything looks okay.
Right. Well, so this is a great spot for us to stop and take our first commercial break. But when we come back, I want to talk about, okay, so what do we do about it if we identify some of these issues? So we will be right back on Sleep Science Today. If you're having trouble sleeping and you need support, don't go it alone. Join us at our free online support group at sleepsupportgroup.com. Just put in your email address, sign up for the list, and you will be notified of all of our upcoming meetings. It's free, so why not try it out?
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
All right, welcome back to Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. We are talking to Dr. Mensch about sleep and cancer and fatigue. So you've got a patient now. You've identified they have, maybe in this particular example, they have insomnia and they have fatigue issues. Can they do anything about it?
Yeah, totally. So I think I said earlier, insomnia is a little bit easier to intervene on because we have wonderful treatments like cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, also known as CBTI, which I'm sure you've had other amazing folks on here discuss CBTI. But just as a reminder, it's an eight-session protocol, give or take, depending on the patient, that intervenes on folks' sleep schedule, right? So we're going to set a standard sleep schedule, going to make sure that people are tired enough to fall and stay asleep till wake time, making sure folks aren't spending excessive time in bed, because one thing we know is that pairing the bed with wakefulness will ensure that your bed and your bedroom is going to elicit wakefulness. I like to call it party time. You know, patients will say to me, I can fall asleep on the couch and then I walk into the bedroom and all of a sudden I'm awake. And I'm like, yeah, that's party time. Like, brain is conditioned by the bed in the bedroom to be awake. Think Pavlov's dogs, right? We are very similar. We are that way as humans. We make associations all the time. Many are below our conscious awareness. Think about eating in front of the TV and getting hungry. I like to watch TikToks, and I found that now TikToks like make me hungry because I watch a lot of TikToks. So those are the associations we're making all the time. I encourage people to pay attention to them. But sleep is no exception, so we intervene on that. And over the course, I'd say, of like a month, people's insomnia resolves if they're adherent to the treatment. And they don't even have to be, I shouldn't say this, but you don't even have to be 100% adherent. This treatment is really robust. So for insomnia and sleep disturbance, we can use CBTI. And it works. Myself and my colleagues, Dr. Perlis and others, wrote a paper called CBTI Works Now What? Because we know that it works for most things and it works really well. Mm-hmm. Fatigue is a little harder because we don't really understand, you know, Andrew, you asked this question, like, why is it happening? Where is it coming from? Gosh, probably so many things. It's like a needle in a haystack. And when do we intervene? How do we intervene? Is there a protocol? There is CBT for fatigue. It's fine. Like, it's there's literature on it. I think the problem that we see, like chronic pain, you know, the pain that's really more psychologically mediated, is we can't like really get it to go away, but we can take the edge off of it. So what do we do? There's some literature to suggest, I think from Sonia and Coley Israel's group, that fatigue is responsive to light. So I have put together a fatigue package, if you will, based on the literature that I know. And so I encourage folks to get a light box. You can order them on Amazon. They're like the size of an iPad. And you use it in the morning. I want to be really specific about this. Don't, you know, give it to yourself at night. You'll give yourself another sleep disorder. We don't have. Yeah, there it is. Yes, there it is. The light box.
On the radio, I'm showing a light box I have on my desk.
Yeah. So it's the size of an iPad. You use it in the morning. And I just really want to be clear on this because we don't have enough time today, I think, to talk about circadian rhythm disorders, but we don't want to give you one. So in the morning, when you wake up an arm's length away, and you use it for about 30 minutes or so for 6 to 8 weeks, and we do see some improvements in fatigue. This is especially helpful for those of us who live in like the Northeast. I'm in the U.S., but in areas where it's darker in the winter, it can also help your mood because we're not getting a lot of sun.
Right.
The other thing that I recommend, again, we talked about energy conservation, so being really intentional about how much energy you're expending and building in breaks, structured napping. So naps, we like to put some boundaries around naps, even if it's after your cancer treatment. So trying not to nap for more than 40, 45 minutes in bed with an alarm before 3 p.m. The reason I say this is oftentimes what happens is, especially after chemo, radiation, folks are understandably tired, they're sleepy, and they lay down and they might sleep for like 2 or 3 hours. Their body needs the rest in illness. However, we want to put some constraints so you can fall and stay asleep at night. So those are some of the things I recommend for fatigue, light, some structured napping if you need it. And then trying to get up at the same time every day, and only going to bed when you're sleepy. The morning time is again tied to the circadian rhythm, which we think gets disrupted in cancer and cancer treatment. And so we're really trying to work on the rhythm to keep your rhythm consistent, which seems to help fatigue.
Wow. So I'm just processing all of what you just said, and the thing that's going on in my brain is, so when we're addressing the fatigue issue, we're talking about light boxes and things on one end, we're also talking about naps and things on the other. So the nap issue, though, doesn't that potentially negatively impact the insomnia issue if they also have insomnia, because now they're relieving their sleep pressure during the day, and now nighttime comes and they need to get to sleep? What happens? How does that all work together?
Yeah, so when I say napping, it's and there, this is up for debate. I had a healthy, friendly debate at the Canadian Sleep Society conference about this. This is really, I'm speaking specifically to illness, and I'm usually prescribing these naps after treatment because folks are really tired. Mm-hmm. And if I don't put boundaries around these naps, they're going to nap anyway. Right? And they're going to nap much longer. So we, so what I try to do is put constraints around it. But if you're doing it in the way I suggest, it really shouldn't be taking away from your sleep pressure. So again, we're saying like maybe 40, 45 minutes in bed with an alarm before 3 p.m., right? So unless you're going to bed at like 7 p.m. or 8 p.m., and if you're listening to this and doing that, you probably shouldn't be. unless you like get up at 3 a.m. So it usually doesn't cause any issue. And a lot of times what happens to the folks that I'm working with who have or who've had cancer is they're not really falling asleep. It's more of like an energy conservation intervention where I'm really encouraging folks just to lay down for a minute and take a break and build that time into their day. A lot of people will say to me, I can't nap. And I'm like, okay, that's okay. What I really am trying to encourage here is just giving your body a moment, especially in the throes of having cancer and going through treatment. We just want to build in a break for you. And so that's also part of this, is getting folks to just slow down so their mind, their body can heal and catch up with itself, because mm-hmm. it's a lot.
Well, yeah, definitely. I can only imagine what they have to go through with all the different medicines / chemicals in their body and just everything. Well, so, all right. So by now, I'm sure you've worked with enough patients that you see sort of a kind of standard routine in a way that you know what to look for. You know what's going on in some of these cases. Is there anything that people can or should be doing proactively if they get a diagnosis of cancer? And I realize that's a very broad word because there's so many types of cancers, but they're going to be going in for treatment. Is there something that they could or should be doing ahead of time to ward off the fatigue or any other type of sleep issues?
Yeah, so from a sleep perspective, insomnia, going back to what we said at the beginning of our discussion around acute insomnia, knowing that in stressful times, it is adaptive and makes sense that our body keeps us awake. Mm-hmm. I'm going to borrow this spiel from Dr. Perlis that when we were, you know, I don't even know, how old is the world? How long have we been here? When we lived outside, and we lived in caves, and we were in danger at nighttime specifically, it probably was adaptive if we thought we were under threat to not sleep. Mm-hmm. Humans are not, I have a cat sitting next to me right now. We're not cats. We don't see well at night. We don't run fast. We don't climb well. And so there was probably some adaptive mechanism that when there was a lion at the mouth of the cave, we would want to be awake. So that is acute short-term insomnia. And if you get a diagnosis of cancer, it stands to reason that you might have a little bit of trouble sleeping. And I just want to put that out there because I think when you get a diagnosis, it's scary. And then all of a sudden you're not sleeping and you're starting to pay attention to like all these internal cues, which can exacerbate stress. Mm-hmm. If the insomnia does not resolve on its own, I would say within, I don't know, what does the DSM say, like 3 months? I would say within like a few weeks, you probably want to let your doctor know that your sleep is getting worse. And if there's somebody like me in the clinic, right, hopefully you can do CBTI and they can intervene. I've done this prophylactically with folks. And there's also medication. So the other thing to, you know, note is that cancer, especially early on, is there's a lot to do. There's a lot of medical appointments. There's medications to take. There's a lot to think about that you might not have had to think about before. There's right. role changes. There's family dynamics. Like, life doesn't stop with a cancer diagnosis. And so CBTI might not also be a good fit because who in the midst of all that, then you have to add on another weekly or biweekly appointment. So there's also medications that can take the edge off, right, too, that your doc can walk you through. So I think just paying attention to your sleep, but not – I sound like I'm contradicting myself, but not too much because we don't want there to be, like, anxiety around it. But just noting if it's been persisting for a while and your daytime is impacted, and then talking to your doc to see what resources are available. From a fatigue standpoint, same thing, right? It is normal, and in your chemo teach, in your discussions around if you're getting radiation or surgery, the medical teams will hopefully tell you this, that you might feel fatigue. And it's common because your body is, you know, working to fight this. You're getting treatments that can cause fatigue, and it's a little bit stressful. So all of those things combined can cause fatigue and maintain it for a little bit. If the fatigue feels like it's impacting your quality of life, though, it's really hard for you to be active. There's things, like I mentioned, that you can do, like light, like activity pacing, structured napping, making sure your sleep is okay, right? Because if your sleep isn't good, that's not going to help the fatigue. There's also medications, excuse me, that some people can take. The jury is out on them. The research is, like, mixed. They don't work super well. Sometimes they take the edge off. They're stimulants called modafinil. Mm-hmm. Docs are also mixed on whether they prescribe them. I think it has to be really dire for folks to prescribe modafinil, but I could be wrong. I think it probably depends on the doctor. But the research, like, isn't great on them, but sometimes the fatigue is bad. So those are things you can do, and you can certainly start these things prophylactically. Just remaining aware that some of this is normal in a stressful time and when your body is, you know, being bombarded with medications and chemo and radiation and all those things.
Right, right. Wow. Okay, well, this is another great spot for us to take our second commercial break here. So I'm going to do that, and then we will be right back on Sleep Science Today and continue our discussion with Dr. Mensch. Have you ever wondered why you can't sleep well? Well, there could be lots of different reasons. In order to figure it out, I wrote the book, Why Can't I Sleep Well? It includes 150 common sleep questions that are asked and answered, and I provide all of the supporting science and evidence to address each of the questions. I encourage you to get a copy of Why Can't I Sleep Well by Andrew Kolsky. It's available at www.sleepsciencetoday.com.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Okay, we are back from our break. Welcome back to Sleep Science Today. So I wanted to follow up on the last part of our discussion here, and it's interesting to me that obviously there's a lot of issues with cancer, fatigue, sleep. There's no question about that. But I would think that there's a lot of other illnesses beyond cancer that have also some pretty rigorous treatment methodologies that probably also lead to fatigue and things. How did it come about that this sleep field merged with cancer as opposed to sleep and health in general? Or maybe I'm getting it wrong.
Yeah, so as I was saying this to you on the break, that I initially, like, I knew that I wanted to work in a health setting as a psychologist and knew early on that I wanted to work in cancer. So I found cancer first and working cancer and helping folks with cancer, survivors, their families navigate this tricky, scary process emotionally, right? And working with medical teams to, you know, navigate that process as well. I often say, you know, I do a lot of consultation liaison work. I'm often liaising. I work for the families and I work for the providers too. So I found cancer and then noted that one of the primary complaints of my patients was that they don't sleep well and they have fatigue. And I went to a didactic in my third year of graduate school, and there was a radiation oncologist who had a PowerPoint up that said 99% of my patients have fatigue and we don't know what to do about it. And I turned to my attending, my supervisor, and said, holy moly, 99% and we're not doing anything about this? This is cuckoo. Like, in what world? This is wild. So I sought out Dr. Perlis, and if he were here, he loves this story. And I asked him repeatedly, can I work for you? And he loves to say he turned me down. So I found cancer first and then sleep. I know. There's lots of sleep researchers and clinicians out there who are working in different with different medical things and diagnoses and comorbidities, same with psychiatric things like depression or schizophrenia. I think you had Michael, I don't know if it's been released yet, but Michael Grander is going to be coming on. He's got a trainee, a medical resident, Andrew Tubbs, who's doing wonderful work in patients diagnosed with serious mental illness like schizophrenia, right? These folks who often may not access these types of treatments like CBTI. So I know there's Sarah Nowakowski's group. Dr. Nowakowski is doing work in women and women's health and menopause and postmenopausal, perimenopause, because there's really a lack of research in women's health and how sleep changes developmentally through our lifespan. So that's all to say that I came to this specifically because I had an interest and I had a great team of mentors, but there's lots of fabulous researchers and clinicians looking at all of these different aspects of health and how sleep interplays into that and fatigue as well.
Right. Wow. Okay. So really the answer is it was just my own myopia that caused the link, because you're right. There are so many people doing research in all these other areas.
So many fabulous sleep and fabulous researchers who are in these, like, their primary interest is in, you know, these other facets of health, and they're bringing sleep into it, right? So eating disorders is an example. There's more work now I've seen over the past few years coming out about how sleep and eating disorders are interrelated. Super interesting stuff. Using, Michael Grander's everywhere, right? He's always in the forefront of my mind. This Michael Grander and Dr. Perlis' Sleep of Reason work, where It's Bad to Be Awake When Reason Sleeps, which is this work on self-harm and risk in the middle of the night. Super important, right, to identify when are folks who might be a danger to themselves or others at most risk, and they're finding that in the middle of the night, right, because you're tired, you're not maybe at your best decision-making capacity, is now being extended to things like eating disorders. Right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
If you're hypofrontal, if your frontal lobes aren't fully engaged, are you at more risk? So there's so much amazing sleep research out there and coming by all of these fantastic folks who I'm glad to call, like say they're in my circle because they're so inspiring. So encourage everybody, if you're interested in this, seek out their work. It's amazing.
Yes, absolutely. The sleep community is relatively small compared to other communities, yeah. But the people in it are amazing.
Just so brilliant.
Yes. So it's really exciting to be, at least for me, I'm sort of on the edge, here, but I get to talk to all the experts, and that's exciting for me because I love to learn about all this.
No, you're in our circle, I would say.
Yeah. Well, I try my best, It's a very interesting topic to me, obviously, or I wouldn't be doing a radio show about it. But tell me this, because you're working on all these things and doing studies and learning more and more every day. Here we are, it's 2025. We've got all sorts of new technologies coming out. You can't go anywhere you don't hear about AI. And then obviously people with sleep talk about sleep trackers. But there's also a lot of things that are not technology focused, just good solid research that people like yourself are doing on issues. What do you see coming up in the future? What's sort of on the edge now?
Oh gosh. Man, that's a great question. Oh, the future, the edge. I mean, I think even in the past, so when did I start working at Penn? Maybe 2015, 2016. The way our wearable technology has developed in, I would say, a relatively short period of time, right, was that mm-hmm. 9-10 years, mm-hmm. is incredible. Like, I don't even know. We had Fitbits, I guess, in 2015, but they weren't what they are now. And the nearable technology, so like your mattresses ability, I have some colleagues who've worked with mattress companies on this, to mm-hmm. like identify how you're sleeping, the Oura Ring, all of this is very, I think we're going to have better ways to track our sleep and our health and how our sleep is related to our health. And all of that is amazing. Mm-hmm. What I want, though, to just like caveat that with is your own subjective, no matter how great these technologies get, and they're getting better every second, your own subjective experience is what matters. So I say this because I encourage all my patients to be their own advocates, right? Like, I try to advocate for every patient who comes through my door, but I also say to patients, I need you to, sometimes when you're in other medical appointments, be your own advocate. If something doesn't feel right, keep pushing forward. And I also say this with respect to wearables and the nearables and all of that, because like, if your sleep tracker is telling you that you're sleeping great, but something doesn't feel right, your sleep tracker doesn't know you and how you're feeling, and vice versa, right? Sleep trackers, especially, I don't want to call out any brand in particular, so I won't, but, but they're not always accurate. I would say more often than not, the threshold for awakening is quite low, so it's going to count more awakenings than maybe you're actually having. And there's a new term called orthosomnia, which is like the hyper focus on our wearables, our nearables, all of it. And so I really encourage people, even with all the fantastic technology we have, to be attuned to themselves and how they're feeling versus what technology is telling us.
Right.
I actually have my patients, I encourage them, I do not want anybody looking at watches. Unless I'm giving them the watch to wear. I have folks who have brain cancer, and sometimes being on screens is really overstimulating to them. And I give them a watch to wear that we are monitoring together. But what I don't want is folks like looking at their watch every 5 seconds and developing anxiety around it. Yeah. So that's a long-winded answer to your question.
No, it's a great answer, and it raises my next question, which is, so, you know, a lot of people wear these different wearables, and they look at their sleep and all this stuff. But do you have any knowledge at all? I'm not aware of any studies, but I have not looked for them either, of wearables tracking sleep versus fatigue.
Okay. So this is actually a really great question that I have not gotten before. So really excellent. So wearables actigraphy tracks your movement. It's on three planes. If you can't see me on the radio, I'm making like an X and a Y axis, and then there's like a Z, right? So it's tracking how you move in space. It is not, these are not tracking your sleep in the way it would be tracked if you went in for an in-lab sleep study, if you will.
Right.
When you go for an in-lab sleep study, they hook you up to EEG. You have electrodes all over your body. It's tracking your brain waves. It's tracking your sleep staging, right? We have different stages of sleep. It's tracking if you have electrodes on your belly, on your legs. And so that is, and you have a sleep tech like watching you all night. All wearables and actigraphy are doing is tracking how you move in space. So the wearables that say it's tracking, your, like your sleep staging, I tell all my patients it can't possibly be. Maybe some respiration, but how accurate is that? So I say this with fatigue because we do use wearables, Fitbit specifically, in our studies to track changes in fatigue. And the way that we estimate this is activity. So how active are you pre the intervention and post the intervention that we're doing? And we use that as like a guesstimate of improvement in fatigue and decrease in fatigue. For sleep, we can through the algorithm say like, when is somebody going to sleep? When are they falling asleep? Are how many times are they like waking up? But it's not really a measure of sleep as much as it is like, again, of activity. So it's actually kind of helpful for fatigue. We don't have a biomarker for fatigue though. Like that we are, I think we're a bit of a long ways away of understanding like the nuances of fatigue and better ways to measure it objectively.
Wow. It'll be interesting to see where we get. I mean, it seems like time is speeding up with AI and all this other stuff. I'm curious what this conversation would be 5 years from now. You know, what
I don't
would
know.
Be
I mean, for fatigue, I think it's really like, again, it's a needle in a haystack, and it's really identifying the mechanisms and how different fatigue differs maybe from one illness to another, even from like one cancer to another, right? Cancers, even within their own bucket, like breast, can be quite different and look differently. You know, you have like different types of receptor positive, receptor negative. I'm just using breast cancer here. And so does fatigue look differently within the same cancer? Should the fatigue treatments be different? Is there a blood test? Right? Like, if somebody comes into your office, if you're a PCP, I use PCPs because that's where sleep often comes through. Right. You're a PCP and you have a patient that comes in and says, you know, doc, I'm feeling really tired and this is unusual for me. I'm not saying all doctors do this, but a lot of times what happens is you get a sleep hygiene worksheet and a prescription for like trazodone, a sleep medication or something of the sort. And what I really advocate for is, sure, you can do that, but what if we like did blood work? What if we had a biomarker for fatigue? Now, this is a messy conversation. I can hear some of my mentors yelling about this because there are immune biomarkers, but they're very nonspecific. But that's like kind of where I encourage, like, I would like the thought process to go. Like, can we do better around fatigue? Is like Michael Graner, this is like the fifth time I brought him up, wrote an excellent paper called Sleep as the Sixth Vital Sign. Which is like true. Sleep tells us a lot about how we're doing, how we're feeling, and I would say fatigue as well. So thinking about it as a vital sign, and if we think about it that way, I think the ideas about how we measure it, test for it objectively, subjectively, how we ask about it in our appointments probably will are changing and will continue to change.
Right. Wow. Wow. So much there. So, yeah. So let me do this. We are out of time for this particular show. So I do want to make the point to anyone who is listening that if you are experiencing any of the things that you're hearing us talk about, maybe you have recently been diagnosed with cancer, maybe you're having some of these problems, or you have a family member, a loved one who is, know that there are things that can be done. There are excellent practitioners out there, researchers like Dr. Mensch herself, who are devoting their careers to working on these things, and they can provide assistance, and some of which you heard about on the show. So please don't be shy to reach out and ask your doctor, you know, can I do something about my fatigue? Can I do something about my sleep? And hopefully they will know where to guide you. With that, I'm going to encourage you all to visit us at www.sleepsciencetoday.com. Join our mailing list so we can keep you informed of updates and new shows coming up and all the important scientific sleep-related issues. And we hope to see you on the next episode of Sleep Science Today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you for listening to Sleep Science Today and learning how to sleep better with your host, Andrew Kolsky, on UK Health Radio. For more information on how you can achieve better sleep, go to sleepsciencetoday.com. Remember, Sleep Science Today and sleep better tonight.